Promises to Keep, How Jackie Robinson Changed America, by Sharon Robinson. Turning to page 3. Jackie Robinson's plaque from the Baseball Hall of Fame. Jack Roosevelt Robinson, Brooklyn, National League, 1947 to 1956. Leading National League batter in 1949. Holds fielding mark for second baseman playing in 150 or more games with a .992 average. Led National League in stolen bases in 1947 and 1949. Most valuable player in 1949. Lifetime batting average, .311. Joint record holder for most double plays by second baseman, 137 in 1951. Led second baseman in double plays in 1949, 1950, 1951, and 1952. Turning to page 4. In memory of my beloved brother, Jack Roosevelt Robinson, Jr. Acknowledgement. Let me begin by giving thanks to my mother, Rachel Robinson, for her love, generosity, and belief in this project. Much love and thanks to my son, Jesse Sims, my brother, David. I'd like to thank the entire Scholastic family, but most especially Dick Robinson, Barbara Marcus, Gene Fuel, Steve Palm, Shelley White, Judy Newman, and Charisse Maloto. A very special thank you to my editor, Sheila Keenan, and to art director, Christina Albertson. I'd like to thank all of my co-workers at Major League Baseball, with special thanks to Commissioner Bud Selig and MLB President Bob DePue. I'd like to thank Jana Perry, Kimberly Allen King, and Mariner Brito for their friendship, support, and assistance with photo research. Special thanks to Leonard Coleman, Marty and Nancy Edelman, Carol Coleman, Brenda Miller, Janice Adams, Jim Kelly, Robin Liverant, Vargrave Richard, Emma Sun, Debbie Sun, Carol Grant, Wendy Lewis, Raymond Scott, Marcia Rubenstein, Casey Wilson, Nell Yamtov, Donna Christensen, and John Blundell. I love each of you. Deep gratitude to the Jackie Robinson Foundation, the Library of Congress, and the Baseball Hall of Fame for giving me access to their incredible collections. Turning to page 6. Introduction. On April 15, 1947, my father, Jack Roosevelt Robinson, stepped out of the Brooklyn Dodgers dugout, crossed first base, and assumed his position as first baseman. He paused, hands resting on bent knees, toes pointed in, then stood, lifted his cap, and saluted the cheering fans. It was a defining moment for baseball and for America. As a result of Dad's accomplishments on and off the field, I inherited a legacy of excellence and service. Today, this legacy takes me into classrooms across the United States, Canada, and the Caribbean. As the Vice President of Educational Programming for Major League Baseball, I bring the Breaking Barriers program into schools, where children, ballplayers, and I talk baseball, values, and books. The kids are naturally curious about my childhood. They want to know what it was like being Jackie Robinson's daughter. They ask me questions such as, did your dad come home angry after losing a baseball game? Or how did you and your family feel about the hate letters you got? But the question that makes me stop and think hardest has been, did you really know your father? When kids ask me that question, I tell them I was 6 when my dad retired from baseball, 12 when he was elected into the Hall of Fame, 22 when he died. I also tell the children that my father taught me to flip pancakes, hit a baseball, question political leaders, solve problems, and keep promises. Whether I was learning to walk, wildly swinging the bat at a fastball, tackling one of my brothers during a football game, or singing a show tune from West Side Story on the rock ledge of our fireplace, Dad encouraged me with praise and loving smile. At times, my father made me feel like I was the most important person in his life. He was fond of saying, "Just put your fingertip in my tea, and I won't need any sugar." I'd giggle and believe I actually had the power to sweeten that cup. When I was sad, Dad was there for me. The first time I cried over failed love, he sat on my bed and reminded me that I deserved better. Over the years, I've learned about my father's baseball days from friends, family, other ballplayers, and even strangers who are anxious to share cherished Jackie Robinson memories with me. To this day, I'm mesmerized by newsreels of my dad rounding the bases, joyously clapping his hands as he outfoxes another pitcher. My father was famous. My brothers and I grew up among awards, trophies, and photographs, but our parents taught us not to worship these honors. They said we should measure our lives by the impact we had on other people's lives. All we had to do was pay attention to the way our parents lived to know that this was true. As a kid, my favorite photograph hung on the wall leading to the lower level of our house. It showed my dad stealing home plate during the 1955 World Series. I passed it several times a day and always paused to look at how a cloud of dirt obscured half of my dad's body, or to study the way his right hand was clenched into a fist. I never failed to notice how my dad's face twisted with fierce determination. Could this be the same man who never raised his voice at home? Looking back, I realized that one of the things I admired most about my father was how he stayed in the game until the end. He stood firm even when his opinion wasn't popular. Whether questioning an umpire or an American president, Dad used his celebrity to challenge an unjust system and support a movement organized to correct the wrongs. So, yes, I knew my dad well as a father and as a man. This brings me to why I wrote Promises to Keep. Though my father's story has been told many times, I wanted the opportunity to tell it in its fullness. Promises to Keep is more than a photographic biography. It's a story about commitment. I've chronicled my father's life through words and pictures as a lasting memory to a man who was shaped by American history and who had an impact on American history. As you read Promises to Keep, you'll see that my father's personal and professional experiences, like baseball itself, reflected the American experience of his time. A lifetime of service was my father's commitment to America and his challenge to you. Whether you commit to study hard, to be a better friend, family member, or neighbor, I hope that through my father's example, you will understand why making a promise and keeping it is so important. Turning to page 8, A Black and White World. My great-grandparents were slaves. My grandmother was a sharecropper. My father was born into a segregated world. Although it may be hard for you to imagine an America where black and white people were kept apart by laws and customs, that world existed. My father helped change it by breaking the color barrier in Major League Baseball. My father helped break down racial segregation. Before we get into the story of Jackie Robinson, however, we need to understand how segregation became a way of life in the United States. The story of race relations in the United States begins more than 400 years ago, when African men, women, and children were enslaved and forcibly brought to the American colonies. The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, ended this terrible, inhumane practice. By 1870, there were approximately 4 million African Americans in the United States who, because of the 13th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution, were now U.S. citizens. As freed men and women, some former slaves attended schools for the first time, farmed in a system called sharecropping, voted, and held local, state, and federal offices. But the new freedoms granted to African Americans were unacceptable to many Southern whites who were used to being in control. These Southerners used political, legal, and violent means to control blacks. They passed state laws to restrict the rights of blacks and to keep them from voting. Even the courts denied blacks opportunities and basic human rights. The Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a state's right to pass racial segregation laws. The Supreme Court's ruling said that such laws did not violate the U.S. Constitution. The nation was divided, those favoring segregation against those who opposed it. The period of legal segregation in America is commonly referred to as the Jim Crow era. In the 1830s, Thomas Rice, a famous white music hall entertainer in Baltimore, Maryland, created a fictional character based on a black singer-dancer. Rice called his character Jim Crow. White audiences laughed at the clowning and foolish antics of the character. Black people found the performances demeaning. They began to use the term Jim Crow to mean discrimination. Going back to page 8, you see a picture that says Slave Quarters, 1860 to 1863. And on page 9, there's a picture, and underneath the caption reads, "This 19th century sheet music shows a Jim Crow figure." Notice that the song is sung by T. Thomas Rice, an Ethiopian. Ethiopia is a country in Africa. On the bottom of page 8 and 9 is a timeline. 1619. People kidnapped from Africa are brought to the Virginia colony. 1776. There are approximately 2 million slaves in the American colonies. After the American Revolution, 1775 to 1783, approximately 55,000 free black people live in what is now the United States. 1787. The U.S. Constitution does not mention slavery, but it does ban the importation of slaves as of 1808. 1861 to 1865, the Civil War rages between the Union, the North, and the Confederacy, the South. 1863, President Abraham Lincoln signs the Emancipation Proclamation, which frees slaves in the Confederate States. 1865, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes slavery illegal everywhere in the United States. 1868, the 14th Amendment guarantees all people born in the United States, including African Americans, citizenship and equal protection under the law. Native Americans are not included. 1870, the 15th Amendment grants all adult male citizens the right to vote. Turning to page 10, Signs of Hope. In the post-Civil War segregated world, black people and white people went to separate schools, ate in separate restaurants, stayed in separate hotels, and sat in separate sections of trains and buses. In many places, they used different bathrooms, telephone booths, and water fountains. Blacks and whites went to separate pool halls, auditoriums, and circuses. Many blacks were restricted from using parks, libraries, and hospitals that served white people. Signs on public facilities often read colored and white in an effort to keep one race from coming in contact with the other. Segregation was part of everyday life almost everywhere, especially in the South. My father was 6 months old in the summer of 1919, the Red Summer. African American blood flowed as black people were assaulted and killed in race riots and lynchings. The racial tension escalated when Southern blacks moved north to work in jobs created by World War I. From 1915 to 1930, nearly 1.5 million black people migrated north at a rate of 100,000 per year. Many of them settled in New York, Chicago, St. Louis, and Detroit. The black families who fled the South during this period hoped to find a better life and escape Jim Crow life. However, they soon discovered that Jim Crow traveled too. The rapid shift in population caused overcrowding in many cities and increased resentment from many white workers who were now forced to work alongside blacks. Looking at the pictures on page 10, Waiting for Colored Only, by order, police department. Many public places, especially in the South, were segregated. Signs of Times. People were even prohibited from drinking at the same fountain. And on page 11, the picture, Negroes have come north to stay. Find chance for independence here. When African American families left the South, they took with them their hopes for freedom and opportunity. Turning to page 12, Mailie Robinson. My grandmother was one of the early pioneering migrants. She lived on a farm in Cairo, Georgia, in 1919 with her husband Jerry and their five children. They were sharecroppers, which meant they farmed a section of land owned by whites for a share of the profit from the crops. This system kept black sharecroppers like my grandparents from getting ahead. Sharecroppers didn't own their own farms. They had to buy all their seeds, food, and equipment on credit from the white landowner. At the end of the year, the black farmer had to give the white landowner up to one half of his crop and repay all the credit. The black farmers ended up with very little and often owed money to the white owner. After dealing with the frustrations of sharecropping, Jerry Robinson gave up and deserted the family. Millie couldn't maintain the farm on her own. But my grandmother was a determined woman with an unflappable faith in God. She packed up her children, Frank, Mac, Edgar, Willie Mae, and Jackie, and took a huge risk. Millie and her family left the only life they'd ever known. They traveled by train to Pasadena, California. There, they lived with her brother until Millie found work and a place for her family to live. My grandmother worked long hours cleaning and cooking in the homes of white families. Meanwhile, she insisted her children keep up their grades, work after school, and attend church every Sunday. The children learned early to protect each other. For a couple of years, my dad's sister, Willie Mae, took my father to school with her. Dad played alone in a sandbox outside her classroom until the kids came out for recess. As a boy, Dad went to Cleveland and Washington elementary schools in Pasadena. The students were black. The teachers were white. My father only got average grades, but he loved sports. With marbles, soccer, dodgeball, and baseball, Dad's reputation as a competitor and a winner began when he was just a young boy. Pasadena was a pretty city with lots of parks and other public recreational facilities. My dad couldn't go in most of them. The local YMCA refused my father membership because he was black. The Pasadena movie houses he went to forced black people to sit in one section. The local soda fountain wouldn't serve black kids. Pasadena was divided into neighborhoods according to race. The boundaries were clearly drawn. Blacks lived in only certain parts of town. That didn't stop my grandmother. Millie and her sister and brother-in-law, Cora and Samuel Wade, raised enough money to buy a house. They ignored the racial boundaries and settled on a house at 121 Pepper Street. The house that they wanted happened to be in an all-white neighborhood. According to family stories, my grandmother knew that the owners wouldn't sell their home to a black family. Millie got a light-skinned niece, who could pass for white, to purchase the Pepper Street house for them. After the closing, the Robinson and Wade families moved in together. The neighbors weren't exactly welcoming. My father was 3 years old when he and his family moved to Pepper Street. When he was 8, Dad got into a name-calling fight with a little white girl who lived across the street. The children's verbal battle was interrupted when the girl's father came outside and started throwing rocks at my father. There were other incidents like that meant to intimidate my grandmother into moving off Pepper Street. A cross was burned on their front lawn. But in spite of the pressure from neighbors, my grandmother refused to leave Pepper Street. Over time, the block became mixed with families from black, white, Asian, and Hispanic backgrounds. Looking at the picture on page 12, the caption reads, Millie Robinson and her 5 children from left to right, Mac, my dad, Edgar, Willie Mae, Frank. They moved from Georgia to California in the early 1920s. The picture on page 13. Mealy Robinson watches Jackie Robinson play ball with his nephew in the yard of the house at 121 Pepper Street. My father lived in the house until 1941. Turning to page 14. While my father fought relatively small battles against racism in Pasadena, African-American leaders across the country took the struggle to a new level. They waged battles in courts, in newspapers, and at street demonstrations. They supported educational and economic equity. Black leaders and activists such as Ida B. Wells, Booker T. Washington, and W.E.B. Du Bois took different positions and offered different solutions to the problems of racial equality. By the 1920s, there were visible signs of hope and progress. Black-owned and operated newspapers like the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, Boston's The Guardian, Ebony Magazine, formerly known as the Negro Digest, the NAACP's monthly magazine, The Crisis, and the Associated Negro Press sprang up to tell the story of racial progress and encourage an anti-segregation resistance movement. There was also a small but growing professional class of African Americans who taught school, worked in hospitals as nurses and doctors, practiced law, and owned businesses. The Harlem Renaissance, named after New York City's vibrant black neighborhood, Harlem, brought forth great African-American writers, artists, and musicians. Artists like Jacob Lawrence, writers like Langston Hughes, Claude McKay, County Cullen, and Zora Neale Hurston. Jazz musicians like Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington. Performers like singer-actor-activist Paul Robeson and dancer Bill Bojangles Robinson all rose to new heights of fame and popularity through the Harlem Renaissance. Looking at the pictures on page 14, top left-hand corner, Mississippi-born journalist Ida B. Wells, 1862 to 1931, used the media to expose the violence African Americans were often subjected to in the 1890s and early 20th century. Wells researched and documented the shocking number of lynchings of black people, including three businessmen friends in Memphis, Tennessee. Despite threats on her own life, Wells continued her anti-lynching crusade through organizing, lecturing, and writing. Middle picture, scholar and writer William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, 1868 to 1963, believed African Americans should be educated and activists. Du Bois was one of the founders of the Niagara Movement, the nation's first biracial civil rights organization, which later became the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Next picture, self-made millionaire Madam C.J. Walker, 1867 to 1919, was an entrepreneur who amassed a fortune through her cosmetics business. Walker was an important supporter of the Harlem Renaissance. Bottom picture, Booker T. Washington, 1856 to 1915, a former slave, became a leading educator, author, and spokesperson for African Americans. He headed Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, an all-black college where students learned vocational skills. Washington believed this type of education would bring black people economic freedom, which would eventually lead to greater freedoms overall. pictures on page 15, starting with the one on the bottom. Legendary band leader Duke Ellington, 1899 to 1974, took his famous jazz swing orchestra all around the world. Top right-hand corner, Paul Robeson, 1898 to 1976, an extraordinary singer, stage, and film actor, stunned audiences with his powerful performances in the film Showboat in 1936, and in stage productions of Othello, 1930 and 1943. Robeson was later ostracized for his social activism. Middle picture. Poet, playwright, essayist, novelist, Langston Hughes, 1902 to 1967, captured the heart and voice of the African-American experience in his work. And bottom right-hand corner picture, Zora Neale Hurston, 1891 to 1960, was an anthropologist and novelist, best known for her book, Their Eyes Were Watching God, in 1937. Turning to page 16. The glory of the Harlem Renaissance was short-lived. In 1929, it was replaced by a deep economic depression. Dad was in junior high at the time. He helped his family out by taking odd jobs like delivering newspapers, cutting the neighbor's grass, and selling hot dogs during football games at Pasadena's Rose Bowl. And he endured the problems associated with being poor and fatherless. When he was a teenager, Dad and his friends formed the Pepper Street Gang. They didn't use drugs, drink alcohol, or start fights. But they did throw clumps of dirt at passing cars, swipe golf balls and sell them back to the golfers, and steal fruit from the local grocers. Several key factors helped my dad avoid serious trouble. The first and most important was his devotion to his mother and the values she worked hard to instill in him. The second was his love of athletics. Most of Dad's energy went into playing sports. In 1935, he was a star high school football quarterback at Muir Tech, where he also played baseball, basketball, tennis, and held records in track. Dad's older brothers were another big influence on him. He really looked up to Edgar, Frank, and Mac. Dad didn't always understand Edgar's odd behavior, but he admired his love of speed. Edgar's feats on roller skates and his bicycle were legendary. It was said Edgar could outrace the bus from Pasadena to Santa Monica, a 30-mile trip. Frank was my dad's favorite brother, but Mac became his idol. When Dad was 13, he watched with pride as Mac won a place on the U.S. Olympic track and field team. Mac went to Berlin, Germany for the 1936 Olympic Games. Dad listened to all the track meets on the radio. The U.S. relay team, made up of African-American athletes Jesse Owens, Uncle Mac, Ralph Metcalf, Johnny Woodruff, and Cornelius Johnson, won the gold medal. By the end of the Olympics, Owens had won 4 gold medals. Mac had won a silver in the 200-meter dash. The 1936 U.S. Olympic relay team's victory was more than a personal athletic triumph. The team won one for humanity. The performances of my uncle and other African-American athletes shattered Nazi leader Adolf Hitler's theory of racial superiority. The Nazis, who rose to power in Germany in the 1930s, believed that select white people known as Aryans were superior to all races, including blacks and non-Aryan whites. German leader Hitler snubbed Jesse Owens by refusing to shake his hand at the Olympic Medal Awards ceremony. But Black America and freedom lovers everywhere celebrated the stunning victory over racism. The 1930s saw the rise of other African American sports heroes. Joe Louis, the Brown Bomber, was one of the most admired athletes of the time. On June 22, 1938, the heavyweight champion faced Germany's Max Schmeling in the ring. Like the 1936 Olympics, more than sports records were riding on the outcome. Europe was on the verge of a Second World War. Hitler gave Schmeling his idea of the ideal racial pure man, a hero's send-off. Americans counted on Joe Louis to bring them victory. The fight of the century was on. It was as if war had already been declared. Louis knocked out Schmeling in 2 minutes, 4 seconds in round one. Joyous Americans all over the country, blacks and whites, celebrated in the streets. But the victory party didn't last. The next morning, America woke up still separate and unequal. Looking at the pictures on page 16, on the top left-hand corner, my Uncle Mac on the left, my father and grandmother, Maley, at 121 Pepper Street in Pasadena. The bottom left-hand picture, Mac Robinson trained for the 1936 Olympics. And the big picture on page 17, the bottom right-hand, the caption reads, Joe Louis's KO of Max Schmeling was headline news all over, as shown on this front page of a Cleveland, Ohio newspaper. Turning to page 18, a determined pair. After graduating from high school in 1937, Dad attended Pasadena Junior College, PJC, where he continued to build his sports legacy. Two important people came into his life at this point. A sprinter named Jack Gordon and a young preacher by the name of the Reverend Carl Downs. Jack and my dad shared a love of sports and developed a close friendship that lasted a lifetime. The minister earned the respect of Dad and his friends. They soon learned that they could trust him with their problems. The Reverend Downs helped guide my father into manhood. At PJC, my father set a national junior college record in track by beating his brother, Max, broad jump record. One newspaper called my father the greatest base runner ever to play on a junior college baseball team. That same newspaper named Dad Athlete of the Year. His exploits on the football field added to the legend. The Pasadena Elks gave Dad a gold football and named him Most Valuable Player. Needless to say, the college scholarship offers piled in. Dad chose to continue his education at the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA. The summer before Dad attended UCLA was a tough one. His mother moved into a smaller house at 133 Pepper Street, leaving the house at 121 Pepper Street to her grown children. That same year, Dad's brother Frank was tragically killed in a motorcycle accident. In spite of the personal loss, Dad started at UCLA in the fall of 1939. He commuted by car from Pasadena to UCLA, where he once again lettered in four sports. By senior year, he was named the best all-around athlete on the West Coast. He twice led the Pacific Coast Conference in basketball scoring, won the Pacific Coast Intercollegiate Golf Championship, and reached the National Negro Tennis Tournament semifinals. But perhaps the most significant thing to happen to Dad that year was meeting Rachel Annetta Isom, my mom. My parents met on UCLA's campus in the fall of 1940. Mom was an eager freshman, just thrilled to be in college. Dad was a mighty senior, stunning athlete, and big man on campus. Mom was attracted to Dad immediately. She liked his warm, engaging smile, and the fact that he was confident without being cocky. In the 1940s, black students at UCLA were a very small minority. Each day between classes, they gathered at Kirchhoff Hall to eat and talk. This is where my mother and father met frequently and then began to date. My parents were serious people with strong personal goals. Each wanted to be somebody. Mom wanted to be the first in her family to earn a college degree. Dad wanted to be a professional athlete. As the romance between my parents heated up, so did America's preparation for World War II, 1939 to 1945. As African Americans protested against their exclusion from the growing defense industry, Dad proposed to my mom. Not long after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed an executive order banning discrimination in all plants working on national defense contracts, my father was drafted into the United States Army. It was still segregated. Looking at the picture on page 18, my father lettered in four sports at UCLA. The bottom picture on page 19, Mom studied nursing at UCLA while Dad served in the Army. She graduated in 1945. And the picture on the far right-hand side, the caption read, Dad's favorite sport in college was football.